134th day of war is already half over as we take you overseas for the latest news in England and Germany broadcast by our own American radio reporters. First, go ahead, London.
This is John McVane in London. German air activity last night is described as heavier than on previous nights. Bombs fell mostly around the northwest, east, and southeast coasts. At least one enemy plane is stated to have been destroyed. In a southeast coast town, the mayor and mayoress are feared to be among the victims. Raids are also reported over Liverpool and Northern Ireland. British night fighters were in action. A small force of the British Bomber Command planes went to northwest Germany last night in very bad weather. Earlier in the evening, RAF fighters carried out a sweep over the French coast and the Straits of Dover, shooting down one German fighter without loss to themselves. Military circles in London this morning said that the position in Crete is more serious. Although no details have reached London detailing the ground positions, these circles say that the German claim to have taken Canea is probably true. Canea, Heraklion, and Retimo are said to be utterly destroyed, and the civilian population are trying to find shelter from the bombing raids. It is possible, however, that light British reinforcements have reached Crete. British papers today print the report that Germany has relaxed the armistice terms to allow the expansion of the Vichy French Air Force to defend the French Empire. The fact that the report is printed without comment here indicates that the real purpose of the measure is not generally understood. The announcement comes as no surprise to French circles in London, and it's possible to reconstruct what is in reality an extremely clever German move, engineered by Admiral Darlan, for the sole purpose of tricking the workers in the French aircraft factories. In the first place, Germany wants France to make planes for Germany. This has become vital now that the Wilhelmstrasse fears that the time is not far off when Germany may have to face the full force of America. American plane production is cutting down the German lead, and only full cooperation of the factories in occupied territory will give Germany even an outside chance of holding her own. But the workers in the French aircraft factories are very anti-German. If they knew that the planes they are making were going to Germany, there would be sabotage and slowdown strikes in production. It would seriously affect the number of planes that Germany could expect to get from the French factories. It's been a relatively simple matter for the Germans to get control of the French aircraft industry. There are only two or three aluminum factories in France. The owners of these factories are known to have readily accepted cooperation with Germany. Plane engines are produced by only three or four factories in France. 2 or 3 months ago, the Germans were negotiating with the owners of these factories for about 3 billion francs worth of orders. But the snag in reaching full production lay in the French workers. At the instigation of the Germans, Admiral Darlan has devised a plan to overcome this obstacle. The Vichy government made a public announcement that the French Air Force, now cut down almost to nothing by the German Armistice Commission, is to be strengthened. The workers are told that all the planes they produce will go to increase the French Air Force. Many may hope that the planes will one day be used against Germany. But secretly, Germany and Vichy have agreed that 7 or 8 of every 10 planes produced will be handed over to Germany. Vichy will keep a very small percentage of the planes, so that in time, Admiral Darlan may be able, by means of demonstrations and public announcements, to prove to the French people that Vichy has, in fact, more planes than when the decision to increase the Air Force was made. Neither Vichy nor Germany will reveal that Germany has benefited 2 to 3 times as much as the Vichy French Air Force. This is the position as seen by reliable French circles here who are in a position to know what is going on behind the scenes in France. The Admiralty announcement yesterday that a French tanker of 5,000 tons steering toward Tripoli with an Italian warship escort had been sunk by the British is the first official statement that French ships are being convoyed by the Axis. The incident is taken in authoritative London circles as bearing out the suspicion that French oil is being sent to the Italians and Germans in Tripoli. It's pointed out here that for some time it has been known that the entire French merchant shipping fleet is under Axis control. Every French ship must have a permit from the Axis Armistice Commission before it makes a voyage. Ship manifests of every French ship, whether from Vichy or occupied France, must first be approved by the Armistice Commission, which can requisition as much or as little of each cargo as it wishes. French ship captains are under standing orders to scuttle their vessels when in danger of being captured by the British, and their orders warn that failure to comply may seriously affect the permits issued by the Axis for French shipping. So far, no French ships have scuttled themselves when capture of the British seemed imminent. The Vichy ships are not allowed to change from one route to another without permission of the Armistice Commission, and the German and Italian authorities have power to order any French ship to go wherever the Axis decides. To boil the whole thing down, if you hear of more Vichy French ships carrying oil or war supplies to Axis ports, it's nothing to be surprised at, because the Germans and Italians on the Armistice Commission are the people who are giving the orders. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Again, shortwave radio spans space between continents, this time so that you may hear our staff reporter in Germany give you the latest news in the Reich. Go ahead, Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. President Roosevelt's talk was commented on again today by Wilhelmstrasse officials. Asked whether the speech had increased tension between the United States and Germany, an official said that Germans didn't concern themselves with that question. We Germans, he said, don't consider that the President of the United States has the right to speak for the whole American people. We can't assume that the American people can agree with or believe in his fantastic statements. It was also said that the speech contained nothing new and that President Roosevelt's arguments were certainly not convincing. The Germans, said this official, consider it tactless to have invited the representative of South American republics in to hear the talk. It is, he said, just one more step toward the isolation of America, toward which Roosevelt is driving the United States. It's presumed that this meant the isolation of the United States from the rest of the world. Caustic comments on the president's speech takes up much of the front page space in the German press this morning. The Volkischer Beobachter, the party paper, closes to Hitler, and a headline brands the speech as a typical product of his Jewish advisors. The paper claims that Roosevelt has again proven to be a bad editorial writer, who is not above descending to the basis morass of topical polemics to reach his goal. So far, says the Volkischer Beobachter, we have tolerated each provocation coming from the president and his likes. But our attitude hasn't been interpreted as coming from our love of peace. Instead, asserts the paper, the German attitude has apparently been used to double these nasty provocations against the Germans. The Berliner Borsen Zeitung goes into the matter of the freedom of the seas and concludes with the statement that Roosevelt may be certain that Germany's war against merchantmen will be pushed until, in the end, no one will be in a position to prevent German sea action. The Zwaffer Blatt, an afternoon tabloid, headlines its comment with the words, quote, Roosevelt cries help for the criminals, unquote. The Berliner Morgenpost headlines its article with, Roosevelt continues his agitation. The paper accuses Roosevelt of sucking his finger while producing such lies as Germany plans for world domination and German plans to attack America. Says the Morgenpost, he speaks of God, but he means dividends. Meanwhile, the Battle of Crete is continuing, and it would seem from reports here that the British and Greeks are losing the fight. Kania, the Greek capital, and Souda Bay have been captured by the Germans, who are advancing eastward. The Allies are said to be in full retreat. Hundreds of British and Greek prisoners are said to have been captured on the coastal fighting east of Souda Bay, as well as large quantities of war material. Some of the prisoners are described as interesting. The Germans say that they not only had to break the resistance of British troops, but that of the Greek irregulars as well. British planes are said to have attempted a strong attack on a German-occupied airfield in western Crete. The attack, it is said, was beaten off and two Bristol Blenheim bombers were shot down. In all, 11 British planes are said to have been shot down yesterday, while the Germans state they only lost one of their own. In the waters around Crete, a British freighter and patrol boat have been sunk. The Germans report that they picked up a single British sailor, the only survivor of one of the British cruisers sunk previously by Stuka bombs. When questioned today on a foreign report that Max Schmeling, former heavyweight boxing champion of the world, had been killed when he landed on Crete as a parachute soldier, an authoritative source said that there was no confirmation of the story here. In Africa, the fight seems to be just as hot. A report here says the British tried to break through German lines before Tobruk. The attack is said to have been repulsed with what is described here as bloody losses for the British. Meanwhile, German planes are said to have carried out a heavy air attack on Tobruk, which resulted in the explosion of a British ammunition dump and the wrecking of a British truck concentration. Near Saloon, the Germans announced that they had captured Helvea Pass, more commonly known as Hellfire Pass. The British were driven out of the pass yesterday. In the vicinity of Saloon, British motorized columns were attacked from the air, and one tank is reported to have been destroyed. Overseas, it's said that German raiders have destroyed another 50,000 tons of British shipping. More details on this action are promised later today. The British were over coastal districts in northern Germany last night. This is Charles Lanius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
Earl Godwin reports now from our newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, and as I was listening to our American reporter from Berlin, the thought struck me, and it'll probably strike you too, that that type of stuff that Berlin is putting out is absolute proof of the second-rate quality of the Nazi leadership. They don't think well. First off, Hitler said that the fireside chat was inconsequential. Then he must have suddenly waked up, because he never starts a smear of that sort until he's really scared. He's a second-rater in thought because he substitutes vilification for analysis, and he substitutes name-calling for real thought. Well, now to get down to the business of news here, I want to ask you a question. How about the men in camps? You know, the president, at his press conference late yesterday, did not concur in an idea that was put up that the selectees are in the army for the duration of a war, but yet he didn't make a complete and specific denial, possibly because it wasn't put up to him in that way. But, off the record, army officers who would not dare be quoted tell me they expect the selectees and the National Guardsmen now in camp will be there a long time, whether by the president's proclamation or through some other circumstance. Production experts over in Bill Knutson's office are working on the assumption that the situation will climax in a long shooting war. State Department officials have the same feeling, that the shooting war will not occur, however, until some Axis gunner lets go. And of course, if that happens, take the advice of an old gentleman, we need American unity rather than leaping up and down and trying to settle all our problems by pasting a sticker on the rear window of an automobile. If there are any of you folks who, along with me, seem to feel that the Freedom of the Seas declaration the other night meant that ships would be sent hither and yon into all the nooks and crannies of the seven seas, including the Red, which makes eight, by the way, well, you may be feel a bit deflated, as I am. You know, we still live under that neutrality act with its vast spaces of ocean into which no American freight ship can go, by our own say-so. Freedom of the seas, explained the president, can be proclaimed and defended without sending American merchantmen into torpedo zones where there is a splendid chance of being hit, shelled, or sunk. And so the seas are free wherever the president says so for Americans. This cautious policy cannot be called a pro-war policy, despite the fact that many of the isolationists believe the proclamation of an unlimited emergency puts us into an undeclared war. That seems to be the debate this morning. And the Wheeler, Nye, Clark crusade is now directed toward muzzling the guns to prevent the shooting war. One immediate tangible situation has to do with strikes in labor. The president, you know, warned organized labor and reiterated at his press conference yesterday afternoon that the government will have to step in and stop the stoppages if defense strikes continue while there's an adequate setup to mediate the differences. At the same time, the president said he wasn't threatening anybody, just laying down a policy. And the Vinson cooling off bill, with its provision of a 25 or 30-day period before any strike can be called here, is given a 10-day cooling-off period itself. The House leaders put the red-hot Vinson bill in the refrigerator for 10 days to see what happens. And Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's all from Washington at this time.
The National Broadcasting Company's news staff is on duty day and night, ready to bring you the first reports of each new development. Please keep tuned to this station continually and be abreast of each new event in this fast-changing world. This is the National Broadcasting Company.